This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Over the years, we've heard about the importance of reading to our children from a very young age. Now there's research that shows just talking to children from the moment of birth can help their brains develop, and the number of words is extremely important.
By the end of the age of three, children born into poverty will have heard 30 million fewer words than their more affluent peers.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll learn about the 30 Million Words Initiative and how poverty may be affecting the way some parents speak to their children. Then it's off to Maine, where we'll meet a teacher whose specialty is guns. And we'll also spend an academic minute with another consequence of poverty, lack of self-control. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Most of the time, we would accept that quality is better than quantity. But when it comes to talking to your young children, quantity has a lot going for it. That's the message of the 30 Million Words Initiative. Dr. Dana Suskin is a professor of surgery and the director of the Pediatric Cochlear Implant Program at the University of Chicago Medicine. She's also the founder and director of the 30 Million Words Initiative, which says that talking to your children is vital to the formation of their young brains, and living in poverty can affect how many words a child ultimately hears. I recently spoke to Dr. Suskin, who said she made this discovery working with hearing-impaired children.
Yeah, so the 30 Million Words Initiative really comes out of my experience as a pediatric cochlear implant surgeon. It was what really allowed me to see that the most powerful thing in this world is basically parent talk. And how it began was probably about 10 years ago, I started our pediatric implant program at the University of Chicago. And an implant, for your listeners that don't know, is an amazing piece of technology that allows a child born deaf the ability to hear, to talk, and most importantly, to meld into this world, both educationally and socially. And so I started implanting these wonderful little babies who had been born deaf, all who looked to have the same potential to learn how to talk and to learn. But very soon after, I started noticing profound differences in how they were doing. So some of the little babies started learning how to talk and ultimately learning how to read and learn on par with their hearing peers, while others, same time out, would barely be able to communicate. And that difference almost always fell along socioeconomic lines. It was a pretty painful difference to watch. And it was that experience that made me ask the question, why, and what could I do? And at the University of Chicago, as with many learning institutions, there are lots of smart people. And I started talking to people and learning, I actually audited a child language development class to try to figure out why. And it was there that I came upon an incredible study, a study done some 30 years ago by researchers Betty Hart and Todd Risley, that basically demonstrated that by the end of the age of three, children born into poverty will have heard 30 million fewer words than their more affluent peers. And just based on the difference in the number of words and, of course, the quality of words, some of those children started on their academic trajectory and had, typical learning. And those who heard less did significantly worse and really started school not ready to learn, had lower IQs and test scores in the third grade. And I came to realize that the differences in how and how much parents talk to their children have profound differences in how kids do academically. So you ask, well, what did that have to do with your patients? Well, I realized that while cochlear implants, the cochlear implant that I provided a child gave sound access. It brought sound to a child's ear and to the brain, something else was needed to make those sounds have meaning. And that important thing was parent talk. And as a result, I started working on a program for children with hearing loss and their families, but very soon realized that what I was seeing in my deaf population really just mirrored what was going on in the typically developing population at large, and really was the root of what we call the achievement gap, and started the 30 Million Words Initiative.
So is this a purely educational gap, or is there actual brain development that occurs with more words?
Oh, that is a great question. In truth, the differences in language exposure, it's not just about differences in building a child's vocabulary. It builds a different brain. because in the first few years of life, the brain is incredibly active. Unlike most of our organs, you know, I always say our heart and our lungs and our kidneys that come out fully formed, the brain is pretty underdeveloped. And it's dependent on what it encounters on those first few years. And in this case, language has a really important role. It not only builds vocabulary, but it builds the brain. And that's why it's so important that children are exposed to a lot of rich, positive language interaction.
And this language interaction should start at what age should this all all begin with?
Let's put it this way. At the end of pregnancy, your baby can actually hear. Now, you know, it's fine to start talking to your baby while he or she is in the womb. But from day one, right, when the baby comes out, you need to be starting to bathe that baby in rich language and really bonding. I mean, language is really just the lens into the whole parent-child relationship. And that should start on day one, because that's when the brain is beginning to grow.
Does the disparity, is it completely economics?
So it's actually, you know, what's important is when you look at Hart and Risley's study and the myriad of studies that have followed, that at first glance it looks like it's just socioeconomic. But what is at the heart is really parent-child interaction. So if you're a well-off family that doesn't interact or talk to your child in those first 3 years, it's going to affect your baby just as negatively. And on the opposite side, if you are a family who, you know, doesn't have the resources, living in poverty, but have, you know, are providing a rich early language environment, your child's going to do great. I mean, obviously, there's complexities of poverty that go beyond this. But at the very heart of brain development is a warm, rich, nurturing language environment.
What about the socioeconomic status of a community? Once someone begins school, does that help or hurt?
Well, you know, obviously, first of all, I want to emphasize that it's never too late. This is not a message that it's ever too late. It's just that if we're going to make impact, earlier is better. And those first 3 years of life, which have often been sort of separated from what we consider education, should in fact be considered part of the educational continuum. You know, the impacts of community-wide poverty, absolutely. I mean, you know, this message, you know, the message of 30 million words and what everybody is doing isn't just a message of tell people to go talk to their kids. It's also a message to society and policymakers that we need to support families so that they can invest in their children. It's not simply enough to say, hey, go talk to your kid. We need policies that also support families, because if you don't have enough food or, you know, have unstable housing or violence, it's not going to be highest on your priority list. Having enough to eat should be first, right? On the other hand, if this message becomes, you know, really ingrained in the community, you know, part of the groundwater, and communities are supported and individuals are supported as should be, we can go a long way towards educational equity. It doesn't mean that it's going to happen overnight. I mean, I think that we all have to have a long-term view of this. There's no silver bullets. Nothing happens in an election cycle. But if we truly want to make change, we have to have this long-term view, this evidence-based view. We need science also at the heart for helping make social change.
When you discovered this and started going deeper into it and finally coming up with a 30 million words program, what do you do now to help both parents and children?
Yeah. So I think what's really important is my reframing the question. It's not what 30 million words does for families and children. What 30 million words does is allow families to understand their inherent power. Their inherent power to build their children's brains. We don't give anything. What we do is we allow families who probably their entire lives too often think that they are powerless, too often don't know the science because we haven't effectively shared it. And what 30 million words is about sharing that science and sharing their inherent power. So with that, we allow families to understand the science, we translate it, understand the simple strategies that can be done in everyday moments, whether changing a diaper or taking a bus to the grocery store, as an opportunity to build a child's brain, that they are, in fact, their children's first and most important teacher. it's often a platitude, but it is so true. But really, this is not just about giving every child the opportunity to reach his or her potential, which is the most important thing. But really, it's an opportunity for society to reach its potential. And the fact that a community views each of these children as their own children is the most important thing. The message is profoundly understandable, right? It's easily digestible. But at the same time, we know that nothing is that simple, right? We know that at the heart of everything is this warm, nurturing parent-child interaction. But at the same time, we also know that at the heart of a healthy, you know, society is, you know, not eating too much, not smoking and exercise, but yet sometimes that's the hardest thing to affect. So, you know, while, yes, it is that simple, a rich, nurturing, warm language environment is the key to getting a child ready for school, but getting to that point, yeah, it's hard. It's hard work. So I think that's the thing that we have to keep in mind.
Well, finally, what's next? Is there 31 million words in our future?
Well, you know, we here at the lab, at the university, we are now talking about the next steps for scaling up, working with communities. Because remember, we're a research lab. We've been testing these things in controlled, you know, science. But the next is, you know, getting it out broadly into the community. So that's sort of our next steps. I think another thing that we need to be really thinking about that's been weighing on my mind is, you know, the issues of technology. You know, yes, we use technology to help scale these things. But I think that all of us can go to a park and know that technology is pulling everybody's bandwidth, you know, from all socioeconomic groups. People are glued to their iPhones and their iPads, and they're not talking to their children. That's going to have long-term issues unless we address it and nip it in the bud.
Dr. Dana Suskin is the founder and director of the 30 Million Words Initiative. Her book, called 30 Million Words, Building a Child's Brain, was published last September. You can learn more at 30millionwords.org. Still to come, there is a large gun culture in the state of Maine, and teaching gun safety is important. We'll meet one of those teachers next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. In Maine, you do not need a license to buy a gun. In Maine, more than 40% of the people own at least one gun. Tatiana Whitlock is a professional firearms instructor from South Portland, Maine, who says teaching gun safety is her number one priority. Tatiana says the gun doesn't care who's shooting it. It just shoots. Salt Radio's Michael Healy reports.
When I first meet Tatiana Whitlock, she's wearing an all-black fleece zipped up past her neck. She has a buzz cut. She has perfect posture, and she looks you straight in the eye. And she is really clear on her philosophy about guns.
The way I look at a firearm is in one of three ways. It can protect the things and the values and the people you love. It can provide, meaning food and sustenance, spiritual, all of that, that is the hunt. And then it's a tool to participate. And that represents the athletic side of what a firearm can do.
That's Tatiana, and firearms are her passion. She even has a favorite gun.
A Nighthawk Custom T4, which is a 9mm 1911 handgun.
The Nighthawk Custom is an all-black handgun. It looks smooth, compact, and well-made, which is part of the appeal for Tatiana.
The artist in me looks at that and just marvels at how beautiful the object is, how precise the fits are, how the tolerances are just make your head spin. It's unbelievable.
Appreciation for a well-made machine runs in her family. Tatiana grew up surrounded by engineers. She herself eventually became an engineer. Childhood was filled with memories of tinkering and experiments.
We learned how to count with muffin tins, counting how many widgets in each muffin tin to then fill a bag to then be packaged for retail. That's how we grew up. We grew up, I mean, the smell of molten plastic was the smell of home. You know, talk about sensory memories from childhood. It's a pretty powerful one. The sound of machinery was musical to us. It wasn't offensive.
College? Check. Industrial design degree? Check. Two kids and two new businesses within 16 months? Check. Life got busy. I think it's easy to lose yourself in your own life, and I think for a moment that was happening to Tatiana. A hobby. There needed to be a hobby. Traveling the world? Not very practical with two newborns. Skydiving? Even less practical. But then there were guns, and that seemed doable. She found a local gun club and signed up for a class.
As with all matters of the heart, when you find home, you know it. And that was it. I was hook, line, and sinker. Joined the club that week, bought my first gun 2 weeks later, and I never looked back.
She took every class offered in Maine, and then started traveling the country looking for more. Soon, she was so skilled she began giving lessons in Maine. And she noticed a trend. While people got into firearms for different reasons, a lot of those reasons seemed to depend on gender. Men, they were mostly in it for the sport, the enjoyment of it. But women...
Women are coming to shooting because they want to take care of and protect themselves. And there's more of a realization that that responsibility falls on them.
Tatiana told me she'd prefer women take mixed enrollment classes. She wants them to see that it can be a hobby too. But she also understands that many women are looking for self-defense, and that sometimes it helps to be in a woman-only environment.
This year I'm doing mostly women's-only courses. The reason for that, while I'm not a proponent of it, is if my goal is to get women through the door, I need to get them to go through the door. So this year I'm doing a lot of women's-only because it'll break the ice. If I can get someone who's hesitant about going into a mixed enrollment class to show up and be introduced to this content, get the confidence, and giving them the opportunity to open their eyes and see that you can shoot just as well as anybody else. You can think and solve problems just as good as anybody else.
Honed, specific, direct. That's Tatiana. She came to our interview with a bunch of facts neatly written on a piece of paper. Her teaching style is the same. Practical. She's teaching and training for the real world, for the nightmare worst-case scenario, anytime you need to use a gun. For example, when you consider worst-case scenarios, like a home invasion, she says the typical practice situation, shooting at a flat piece of paper from 21 feet away, it just isn't practical.
21 feet, 7 yards, a very common training number. That's a numerical statistic based on two car lengths from their cruiser to the top of the other vehicle they've pulled over is typically 21 feet, 7 yards. Is the training environment contextually based to match my life?
Like, what if you have to use a gun in your home?
What's the distance from your nightstand where you keep that firearm when your kids aren't home, ready to go, and your bedroom door? You might be amazed that it's only 3 yards. Wow. You know, or less. You have to train for the fight of your life so that you can save your life.
Thinking about defending yourself with a gun in your bedroom, it's intense. There's no way around it. And for some people, taking a class focused on that can be stressful, especially for new students.
You can get so wrapped up in the object that is the firearm that you forget the reason why you're doing it.
So Tatiana also offers to meet with each student before they begin lessons. It's usually at a coffee shop, a casual place to ask any questions they want. There are no guns, no ammunition. There's probably some jazz playing in the background.
It almost always comes down to the fact that they are overwhelmed with what they know they don't know. And that fear of feeling completely overwhelmed and incompetent with this thing that could hurt you or hurt someone else, and the responsibility is enormous.
Which makes sense. It is a big responsibility to own a gun, especially if the person who's worried has kids.
Now you can multiply those by 10 to 100 times, because that just seems to be what really sets people over the edge.
Once she met a student who was particularly stressed out, they decided to meet at a Panera Bread just to chat.
She had to take some anxiety medication before she arrived, and she was shaking. She was terrified. And we were just talking about this. That's it. We weren't at the range. There was no loaded magazine being fed into a gun in a round chamber. We were just talking, saying the words.
And Tatiana can understand that kind of anxiety. She's a mom. She has her own kids. But she says the key is to store them safely and to have a plan for how to integrate firearms and home life.
The goal with kids and guns is that they are no more intrigued or interested in the object that is the firearm than they are about the blender or the toaster or the bandsaw in the basement or the cutlery in the kitchen or the poisonous chemicals that live under your sink.
It's clear that a lot of women get into firearms for different reasons than men do. It made me wonder if there's sexism within the community of people who own guns. But Tatiana made it clear she doesn't feel any gender bias, that there's no space for it. As she told me, the gun doesn't care if it's pink or black. It just shoots. Still, I wondered if there was a sense of empowerment for women who learn how to use a gun. So I asked Tatiana, does she feel like she's empowering female students when she teaches them how to shoot?
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think I am empowering my male students when I teach them how to shoot? Is that a sales pitch that you would give to a guy? Come take a lesson with Tatiana because she's going to empower you. I wouldn't make that sales pitch to a guy. Why am I making it to a woman? It implies that she's already defenseless. It implies that she's already less than. She's already diminished. And I don't care for that. It's a way for you to reconnect with your own strength. It's a way for you to make the connections with facets of yourself that are already there that perhaps you didn't know about. So in many ways, it's just reintroducing women to the fact that they are strong and that they can be, and that here is a vehicle to bring you there.
For Salt Radio, I'm Michael Healy.
If you have a lack of self-control, it could have something to do with your bank account. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
What does self-control and poverty have to do with each other? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College, and today on the Academic Minute, Elliot Berkman, assistant professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Oregon, explores how self-control and a focus on the present can make it hard for people to position themselves for success in the future.
When we think of good self-control, we usually think of personal factors, such as grit or willpower. There's been plenty of research on those, but recently, psychology researchers have begun to investigate factors outside the person that contribute to good or bad self-control. One such factor has leapt out: poverty. Scientific evidence suggests several reasons why even smart and capable people can become trapped in a cycle where failed self-control and poverty each perpetuate the other. One reason is that poverty forces people to spend time thinking about their basic needs. This leaves less mental bandwidth for abstract thought, such as planning for the future. A series of studies in both the lab and real world found that scarcity of resources caused a 13-point drop in people's IQ. That deficit will make it hard for anyone to engage in the kind of high-level thinking involved in self-control. Poverty also forces people to live in the present. This is a challenge because the very definition of self-control is choosing behaviors that favor long-term outcomes over short-term rewards. But why worry about tomorrow if you don't know you'll survive today? Research supports this idea by showing that poor people have an increased focus on the present and tend to spend their money on immediate needs such as food and utilities. Poor self-control also gets transmitted across generations because poverty limits opportunities for parents to teach self-control to their children. Children are better at self-control when their parents teach and model independent problem-solving and active decision-making. But that kind of involved parenting takes time, and financially poor parents are often time poor, too. This is not to say that poverty is hopeless. There are lots of ways to teach people how to become better at self-control. The key to helping people is not to blame them, but instead to address the underlying factors that perpetuate poverty, especially among children.
That was Elliot Berkman of the University of Oregon. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.